trails thereabouts.
Any luck? He wonders.
Not yet, BJ says. They've called off the ground search, at least for now.
BJ spends a few minutes explaining what they've done, bringing him up to date. Then she starts talking about statistics. She explains that she would like to reopen the ground search. She has some ideas, and she thinks this might be a good place to search with dogs. They can call in dogs from Central Lakes and other dog squads around the state. Since Two Harbors has gone back to their garage, the Finland squad could take the lead. She knows Pete worked the weekend and has Monday and Tuesday off. Pete's fresh. He hasn't yet set foot in the woods, so he's an easy sell.
Call Van Kekerix and make sure he's okay with it, Walsh suggests, though he already knows Steve's answer.
Make sure dispatch sends out another call for volunteers to meet us there at first light. Just to be sure, I'll make some calls tonight. Pete Walsh has a list of friends almost as thick as the Finland phone book, and those he doesn't know personally are at the very least friends of relatives, or relatives of friends. This evening, before he turns in and settles down to sleep, Pete Walsh has wrung agreements out of several searchers. They'll meet him at first light, up in the trailhead parking lot. Some from Finland, Captain Swede Larsen and four others from the Silver Bay squad, and still others coming in from Two Harbors. With any luck, they'll snag a couple of DNR conservation officers. Kip Duncan out of Two Harbors and Marty Stage out of Babbitt. He's got a good crew for the morning. Before he turns off his light, he sets his alarm. Back at home, BJ starts to re-examine all the maps. Van Kekerix thought her idea was excellent, and he asked dispatch to put out another call for volunteers. He also told her to call out the dogs, literally. She would have her people and their dogs' superb noses. He'd be up, too, later in the morning, when he could spare the time. Before Steve Van Kekerix turns in for the evening, he makes a late-night call to the Rasmussens. They're up. He knew they would be. He tells them the search is starting afresh, and this time they are bringing in dogs. They will find him, he reassures them. He hopes it won't be recovery, but that's a thought he keeps to himself. Some of these dogs are trained to smell death. He only tells the Rasmussens about the ones who are trained to find Jason alive. Back in bed, before BJ drops off to sleep, she thinks she has an idea of where else to search. And there will be dogs, she knows. The dogs are coming. 18. Bushwhacking the Quetico Woods. Quetico Provincial Park. Thursday, August 7, 1998. Every hour and a half, Dan Stevens checks his watch, stopping to drink water, rest, and reevaluate his position. At his first stop, he stumbles across a patch of arrowroot. Its large, spiked leaves flow down to the water's edge. He grabs one of the plants by the base of its stem and pulls it up, as though he's harvesting radishes. He cuts off the bottom white root, discards the leaves, and swishes the root in water, cleaning off dirt. It looks like a small white carrot. He recollects the taste of a carrot, its gritty sweetness. He hopes the arrowroot measures up. He snaps it in half, places the small half in his mouth, and starts chewing. There is an immediate taste of bitterness. He is hungry, and hopes it will pass, but after a couple more chews, the bitterness intensifies, like the taste of hard, black rubber, and he spits it across the water. He cannot believe people eat this. He wonders if he made a mistake, but the long, spiked leaves, wide like arrowheads, reaffirm his choice. He is still spitting, trying to get the taste of acrid rubber out of his mouth. He takes a drink of water and swishes. He spits, but the taste has penetrated the inner lining of his mouth. He drinks again, swishes, but the rinse does little to diminish the awful bitterness. He knows some plants are edible at different times of the year. Maybe in the spring, he thinks. He suspects he tried arrowroot at its worst time. Throughout the day, Stevens pushes his way south in a near straight line. He uses a navigational technique he recollects from scouting texts, the two-stick method. He finds a straight stick, plants it in the ground so that it points directly into the sun without casting a shadow. Then he waits 20 minutes for the sun to shift. The shadow the stick casts from the sun's movement points due east. He uses another stick,
laying it perpendicular to the shadow, marking the direction south. He takes his bearings along a long line southward, whenever possible marking them against a distant landmark, a crest of hill or a towering white pine, and then keeps walking, keeping his navigable landmark in sight. All morning he repeats the two-stick method. Whenever possible, he hikes the ridges, walking along the rocky outcrops until he is forced to leave them and turn south. Then he crosses another valley of bogs and thick brush. The sharp trees and brush cut his legs. He struggles to make the next ridge, following it south as long as it holds, then repeating his boggy amble. Twice he hears a plane in the distance. He suspects they are looking for him. Once in mid-morning, a helicopter thunders by within eyeshot. He is on a slightly forested hillside, heading down to cross another section of swamp. He jumps and shouts, waving his arms and his long walking stick in the air. But Dan knows that even if they were right on top of him, he would be difficult to see. It would be better if he were in the middle of the lowland in front of him. But even there, the brush is too high and overgrown. His efforts to alert the aircraft are futile, and he reaffirms his belief that the only way out is to continue hiking south. He maintains his direction. Now that he has recovered his clarity, his will, he doesn't make mistakes. He is familiar with the rule of dominant-handedness. His right side has always been stronger than his left. He knows how to compensate. He is careful to stop every 90 minutes to take a drink and recheck his position. By this reckoning, he crosses more lowland swamp and intermittent ridges, trying to keep to the high points, only walking down into the thick brush long enough to make the next ridge. By late afternoon, he is satisfied with his progress, knows he must find some place to bed down for the night. The next ridge is a clear promontory, better than the previous night's site. He struggles up the high escarpment. At its top, he is rewarded by an old blueberry patch and another widowmaker birch. A handful of succulent fruit clings to a few remaining bushes. He forages the hillside and devours the meager supper. The berries are sweeter than anything he has ever tasted. He lingers over each tiny berry, savoring its flavor, sucking down its sweetness. He reflects on some of his past meals. Nothing, not the finest restaurants he can recall, hold a candle to the tiny blue berries cradled in his fist. While the light is still strong, he approaches the birch. The tree is huge, one of the largest he has come across. He revels at his good fortune, sinking his knife into the thick trunk. He cuts off 3 large coils of waterproof bark, repeating the process from the night before. He crosses over the ridgetop. The eastern side is clear, a fitting place to reconnoiter and warm himself in tomorrow's dawn. Now he recrosses the crest line, finding an open place where the sun's last rays will warm him. He scours the hillside for broadleaf. In his forage, he hasn't seen any bear scat. He fashions his makeshift shelter and lies down as the evening darkens. Back at the OPP base camp, the ERT crew settles in for the evening. They built a large fire pit in front of the crowded cedars. The blaze is an excellent way to keep the bugs at bay. Here, the trick is to follow the smoke, to stay just to the side of it so the mosquitoes won't hound or hinder. The men have hats with netting, and someone had the prescience to pack in suitable refreshment. After dining on pork chops, they sit back and enjoy the evening. The helicopter rests on the makeshift pad. The tents are set up near the fire. They are all tired from the last 24 hours. Most of them have made long bushwhacks to the nearby woods. The dogs rest beside the firelight. There is nothing to do but wait for first light. The group is hopeful about tomorrow. They've already crossed much of the grid, and by the end of tomorrow they suspect they will have their man. In the closed darkness they finish their drinks and plot the morning's efforts. More of them will turn south. Some will cross the lake and hike further north, just in case. Scott Moore and the pilot will rise at first light and fire up the copter, crisscrossing north and south. They are in the right place to be searching. They are confident that if Dan Stevens is still alive, they will find him. In the waning hours of the day, Sergeant Lacey makes one last call to Jim and Mary Ann Stevens. Lacey has been true to her word, periodically phoning Dan's parents with updates. She tells them not to worry, to try to get some sleep. The OPP is on it. They have plenty of men, dogs, and supplies. They are going to find their son. Tomorrow, she says. Tomorrow she is certain their boy will be found. Back at the Prairie Portage Station, Kathy Antle and Carrie Frechette have been busy with the day's travelers. They waited until Jerry Wills returned from his copter ride. He informed them about the ERT and the swarm of constables searching the bush. He was hopeful about their search, increasingly confident that his and Tim Jones's decision to paddle for help had been a good one. Tomorrow is Kathy Antle's day off. She will make the long trip to Summers in the morning. Summers is only 20 miles up the road from Ely, where the scout group is headed, and where she needs to go for some badly needed supplies. She will try to hook up with the fathers then, and give them any news of the search and rescue progress. The previous day, Joe Matson and the chaplain had ferried the boys and canoes back to base camp, speeding down the length of Moose Lake in the only section of the boundary waters where motorized vehicles were allowed. The scouts took over one of the camp's vacant barracks. Now Jerry Wills and Tim Jones take the remaining canoe and paddle the distance down Moose Lake to Summers. Over supper, they are happy to be reunited with their troop. In the evening, they bed down in the relative ease of the base barracks. They all turn in early, exhausted from their ordeal. Before bed, they gather inside the small room, where Jerry Wills leads them in a prayer for their guide, entreating God for his safe passage. In the night, on his remote escarpment, Dan Stevens drifts into a troubled sleep. The map dream reappears to him. The familiar yellow and blue chart is spread out before him. He searches for the dot signifying, "You are here." But across the wide table he can find nothing. He recollects the northwest-southeast drainage he is traversing, determines, in his dream, to remember the message. And then he slips into a shallow and fitful sleep. Found. I had stopped at night, and being unable to make a camp or kindle a fire, I was endeavoring to reconcile myself to the immediate approach of death, which I thought inevitable, when these people unexpectedly found me and helped me to return to camp. John Tanner. A narrative of the captivity and adventures of John Tanner. A great thirst is a great joy when quenched in time. Edward Abbey. Desert Solitaire. 19. Searchers find a clue. Powwow Trail Region. BWCAW. Monday, October 29, 2001. By 9:30 a.m., B.J. Kohlstedt is on the phone to the Search and Rescue Dog Associations, SARDA. Central Lakes Search and Rescue, the dog group B.J. met in her October seminar, is one group among a half dozen located throughout the state. None of them resides in Lake County. The call goes out to the network, and several of the statewide groups respond. It will take them time to gear up. According to Carla Leahy at Central Lakes, B.J. should expect at least 2 dog teams, probably more, by 6 p.m. Pete Walsh acts as incident commander, stationed in the Finland Search and Rescue Communications Vehicle. At times, B.J. shares the center, or heads out to make another foray into the woods. There are several paired parties making numerous excursions throughout the area, both nearby and much farther up the trail. Kip Duncan and Marty Stage, DNR conservation officers, have both heard the radio chatter and added their own legs to the effort. They are sent off south on the trail, motoring over the old path on ATVs. The airplane is back up. Nick Milkovich and pilot Dean Lee are crisscrossing the region. The previous night's thermal search turned up nothing. The Transportation Department's chopper pilot assures Van Kekkerix that if Jason was alive and giving off heat, breathing, or stumbling through the cold terrain, his heat signature would give off a glow as distinct as a camp lantern. They would have found him. When Van Kekkerix makes the call to update the Rasmussens, he leaves out the pilot's certitude. If he's hunkered down in some kind of shelter, Steve suggests, he's probably not giving off much of a thermal signature, at least not something you can easily see from that high. Before signing off, he reminds the Rasmussens the dogs are coming. At 11:30, the plane takes a low swing over the northwestern corner of Isabella Lake. Nick Milkovich thinks he sees something. In the warmer weather, the heavy accumulation of wet snow has begun to melt so that in patches the ground is now clear. The woods are wet and muddy. Milkovich and Lee take another spin over the area and spot a small orange swatch near the lakeshore. It looks like a piece of tent. Jason, they know, had an orange tent fly. They hone in on the coordinates, circling the spot long enough to get firm GPS readings. Then they radio the location to base camp and tell BJ and Pete Walsh they think they have something. For 3 days, an intensive air and ground search has come up empty. Suddenly, they may have their first clue. The location doesn't make any sense, but the orange color draws them like a beacon. Pete and BJ reroute the two conservation officers. They send them north on the ATVs to a close point on the trail. Then the two Coes turn into the woods on foot. From the air, the region looks impenetrable. The simplest approach appears to be by boat. Pete and BJ also dispatch a runabout. The boat leaves at the same time as the Coes. In the wake of excitement generated by their first potential clue, the two teams race toward the orange swatch. Down in the cities, Ken Anderson gets a call. One of the dog teams has asked for his assistance. Ken is president of Emergency Support Services, ESS, a company he established to teach rescue skills to volunteer and civic groups. Because Ken is familiar with search and rescue and knows how to work with dogs, he is more than happy to head north. Ken calls his friend Jeff Hossie, another experienced rescue person and dog handler. Jeff works as a paramedic in Chanhassen, but he often goes out with canine units on search and rescue, or recovery. Jeff is president of Midwest Technical Rescue Training Associates, MTRTA, a company he founded to teach rescue skills to groups like Lake County Search and Rescue and the dog teams. Over the last few years, Ken and Jeff have come to understand and rely on each other's strengths. Jeff is a paramedic with excellent climbing, field, and communications experience. Ken is a master cartographer with a laptop and a load of radio gear. Together, these two have teamed up to work on a variety of searches, with dogs and without, as ground pounders or in leadership positions. Jeff is at work when he gets the call at 1 p.m. He has to find someone to take his shift, but he's in. They haven't been told much about the effort, only that it has been ongoing, and this is the fourth day. Together, they pack their copious gear into the back of Ken's reinforced pickup. They start out of the cities around dinner time, heading north, Ken's truck riding low from the weight. Back near Isabella Lake, the pilots report the orange swatch, and everyone in the field takes a collective breath. Then radio chatter swells to a cacophony. Once the Coes and the boat are dispatched, the other ground pounders continue their current searches, but they keep an inquisitive ear bent toward their radios. It takes an hour and 40 minutes for the Coes and the boat to converge on the orange object. By the time the Coes crash through the woods, the boat crew has already recovered the material, a rectangular piece of heavy orange nylon. It could be part of a tent, but it appears to have been cut and torn into a long rectangle, and it doesn't match the lightweight material of any tents the searchers know. They begin circling the area, but there are no tracks or other signs of movement or habitation. The fabric could have been packed in over the winter ice. The boat crew is careful to mark the spot. Everyone has the GPS coordinates locked in. The boat begins patrolling up and down the extensive Isabella shoreline, looking for clues. The Coes, already in the woods near the site, begin making broad circles in the trees near the shoreline, looking for other signs of Jason's passing. Other searchers are pulled from nearby bushwhacks and sent in to assist the officers. Pushing through the heavy, difficult terrain makes for a strenuous afternoon. By the end of it, neither the boat nor the ground pounders have turned up anything. It appears the orange swatch fell out of the sky. Just a few miles from the scene of converging searches, Jason Rasmussen tries to moisten his lips. His mouth is parched and his tongue and throat are dry. Despite the area's ample snow, This is the third day Jason has tried to sate his thirst with one cup of melted water. He is weary and discouraged, and throughout the day he is often seized with the urge to lie down and doze. But the repeated droning of an airplane convinces him to stay awake, against the remote chance the pilot flies directly overhead, and, by some divine miracle, looks down the exact moment he raises a weary arm. He is tired. He cannot remember feeling this weak. His left foot is numb clear up to the arch. He tries to wiggle his toes, but if they move, he cannot feel it. He doesn't want to stand. He wants to lie down and sleep. But somewhere in the back of his mind he knows sleep is a metaphor for death. Sleep. The sleep he contemplates, the one in which he lays down his burden and puts it finally to rest, is not what he wants. Not now. There is too much left for him. Too much to do. Overhead he hears the plane, further south now, well out of view. The wind picks up in the trees, and he listens. Somewhere over the ridge he thinks he hears people talking. He is startled. He is certain there are voices, but he cannot discern their words. "Down here!" Jason yells. His voice is not much louder than a sparrow's squawk. He hasn't uttered a vowel in more than a day. "Here!" he manages with more emphasis. And then he listens closely and notices it is only the wind. The wind in the trees is sowing mischief. He listens intently just to be sure. But there are no voices, only a faint breeze presaging more gray weather. Later in the day he pulls out his birch bark letters. He reviews what he wrote to his folks and to Heidi. They are reasonable starts, but they are only beginning. He needs to say more. He must tell them things. He knows he cannot lie down and sleep, lie down for that final rest in his pine chamber until he has finished these letters. By the time the day turns dark, he is still working on his words. Tired as he is, he knows he must survive another evening. He has to finish the epistles to his family. There is so much to say. He has chosen to begin with the practical, explaining about passwords and accounts, the necessary business of life we take for granted. And then he begins to pick up the reins of his most difficult challenge. Jason Rasmussen has always been a quiet, private person, but he loves his parents, his little sister, his life. On reflection, he knows he has been blessed. In the waning light of the day, Jason is overcome with gratitude. He sits on the edge of his log, his feet frozen, his body slowly starving, thirst scratching his throat. He is more tired than he can remember, and he shivers. Shivering has become a periodic routine. He knows his body is slowly growing colder, freezing. But before he lays down his bark, placing the letters out of harm's way, Jason feels a kind of grace he cannot recall. He tells his parents he has had a good life, a great life. By early evening, several of the searchers have decided to call it a day. A few decide to wait for the dogs. Search and rescue episodes have a life of their own. This one has already far exceeded the ordinary span devoted to most of these undertakings. But Jason's car sits in the lot, a constant reminder that he is out there, somewhere. And in spite of their poor luck, they have a clear sense of where he went into the woods and his intended route. He is still out there. The knowledge has sustained them long beyond a normal search and rescue. Finding the orange swatch blew momentary life into their efforts, gave them hope. Though it proved to be nothing, it had re-energized them. Now the dogs, new searchers with fresh perspectives and hounds, are about to have the same effect. People are looking forward to working with the dogs. After an early dinner, BJ and John, still pursuing their single dubious clue, decide to canoe along the southern Isabella shoreline and take a spin up Parent River and Powwow Creek, all the way to the Fern Lake Portage. They set off at 4 o'clock, just about the time the sun is hanging low above the western horizon. It is a cold 3-mile paddle. The map shows no easy traverse to the Portage area, at least on foot, but it's an open waterway, and Jason could have changed his mind. If he hiked toward Isabella, then around the southern shore, or through the southern woods, he may have been able to bushwhack to the location. It's doubtful. but in the last 3 days they have checked all the obvious places. They have hiked the entire trail. They haven't yet been up Superstition Spur, but they scheduled the crew to get in tomorrow. They have examined all the areas around the trail. Now they are waiting for the dogs. John and BJ are gone until well after dark. Throughout the day, the temperature, mild in the morning and midday, has taken a cold plunge. The canoeing pair notices the drop. The edges of Parent River start to crystallize. But they make the fern-like portage by dusk and decide to hike the 252 rods into the lake, just to be certain. But there is nothing. And by the time they return to their canoe, it is dark. Back in the communication center, Pete Walsh is worried about the couple. He checks in by radio every 10 to 15 minutes. By the time the couple has paddled down the length of the Parent River, the water is starting to freeze. They have to break their way through the ice with paddles and the aluminum canoe bow. At around 6:30 p.m., Pete Walsh calls the canoeing couple for a regular checkup. "This is 1C calling John and BJ. How's that paddle coming?" he asks. He waits several moments for a response, but there is none. He waits a little longer before repeating, "This is 1C calling John and BJ. Give us a call back, eh?" But there is still no response. Pete starts to worry, counting the minutes between calls. Search and rescue personnel often count the highest incident of lost or hurt people among their own. And with so many searchers on this case, already over 40, Pete guesses, and there are going to be more, it is practically inevitable that one of them will be hurt, stranded, or lost. He is already thinking about who he can send out after them. Then the radio crackles back.
"We're still here," BJ says. "Must have hit a low spot. We lost your signal for a second."
Pete Walsh is elated to hear her voice.
"Those are about the sweetest words I've heard today," he says. There is a collective chuckle over the airwaves.
"It's tough going," BJ explains. "The ice is thickening up fast, but we should be back within a half hour, I expect."
At around 7 p.m., just about the time BJ and John return, Central Lake's search and rescue is on the scene. They have 3 teams and 1 communication support person. Their 3 dogs are certified, 1 for tracking and 2 air-scenting dogs. BJ remembers from her discussions with the handlers that search and rescue dogs come in 3 types, trackers, air-scenters, and cadaver dogs. The trackers are the animals most people imagine when they think of dogs. Trackers take a person's specific scent and follow it through the woods. Air-scenters, instead of relying on tangible ground crossing, pick up scent molecules in the air, finding anyone who might be in the area. Trackers are sometimes more certain, but air-scenters are often easier to work with.
"It depends on the terrain," Carla Leahy is quick to point out.
Earlier, B.J. Kolstedt, who was given a key to Jason's car by Steve Van Kekerix, used rubber gloves to open Jason's trunk and extract one of his shoes. The dogs are given the shoe to pick up Jason's scent.
"In this country," Carla continues, "I'd almost rather have an air center."
She explains that you follow trackers on their trail, wherever it leads. Dogs, she points out, can often fit through brush holes and thickets a human has to hack through, or crawl through on all fours. The areas around the powwow have thickets that even in early winter form a weave as impenetrable as a Georgia swamp. BJ and Pete Walsh explain what has already been done. They want one of the crews to head into the area where the orange swatch was found. The other two, the tracker and the air center, should start up the trail and see if they can pick up anything. The time is perfect, Carla knows. She and Dale, her husband and the one who is taking the air center to Isabella Lake, prefer working at night. So do the dogs. Sherry Wright, the group's communications person, sets up in the van with Pete and BJ. Throughout the late evening, other dog handlers come on the scene. Wendy Dean with Cassie, a tracker, and Jim Couch with Tanner, who is both a tracker and air center. They are both sent out to cover more parts of the trail. At 11:30 p.m., Ken Anderson and Jeff Hossie finally roll into the trailhead parking lot with their truck full of gear. Neither has ever been to the old Forest Center parking lot. Unless you are local, it is not an easy place to find. This far north and on the edge of the BWCAW there are few road signs, and the fact that Hosse and Anderson locate the lot in the dark on their first try is a testament to the pair's navigational skills. Pete Walsh, Pete Smirid, and Sherry are in the communications vehicle. BJ has gone out in the field to assist with one of the dog teams. Ken and Jeff introduce themselves and begin to explain why they've arrived and what they can do. The two Petes bring the recent recruits up to date, describing Jason, the search and rescue, and the areas that have already been searched. By this time, the entire trail has been covered, and many areas around it, including the northwestern corner of Isabella Lake. Clues are starting to turn as cold as the weather. Ken and Jeff look at the swatch. Neither of them believes it is from a tent fly. The fabric is too heavy, and they have never seen any tents of that particular hue, more of a burnt orange or orange-red than the kind of orange you see in the field. From experience, the two search and rescue professionals also know coming onto an active scene can be a threat. Depending upon the personalities of those heading up the effort, they can feel welcome or practically shunned. If welcomed, they are more than ready to take a lead role, helping with theories, communications, cartography, and whatever else the search demands. If shunned, they are happy to serve as ground pounders in the field. The two Petes have been on enough of these efforts to know every extra hand is invaluable. The more experience, the better. When Jeff and Ken begin asking questions about maps and communications, the efforts to date, the overall plan, and where the search is heading from here, the two on-site commanders begin to realize these urbanites may not know much about the powwow or its surrounding woods, but they are plenty informed about search and rescue. The command center vehicle has a laptop with a mapping program hooked to a printer. Pete Smirid is operating the equipment. But when Smirid begins demonstrating its capabilities to Ken Anderson, the hard disk fails. There is a collective gasp in the van. These maps help guide the search and track the areas already covered. Fortunately, Ken Anderson has come prepared. He hooks up his laptop and begins displaying USGS aerial photos of the powwow and surrounding country. He has other mapping programs. The application has the flexibility to focus in close or from far away. And he can create custom subsections of these maps, writing on them, or highlighting trails and the locations of search teams. Not long after Anderson gets started, two or three customized maps spit out of the printer. One of them lays out the entire area, highlighting the current powwow trail and sections of the old trail that they label the North Loop and East Loop. The map joins others on the wall of the Incident Command Center. The cartographers are back in business. Throughout the night, 1C is in constant radio contact with the dog teams. They have moved far up the trail and into the woods, but neither the tracking dog nor the air centers have located any trace of Jason Rasmussen. Around dawn, the teams make their way to pickup points on the trail. They are tired, hungry, and cold, and the ATVs are going to come in and meet them, then ferry them back to home base. Carla Leahy lets 1C know she is at the pickup point. The team sent to fetch her reports that they are at the juncture, but Carla is nowhere to be found. 1C begins querying both groups about their surroundings. The juncture at which the powwow begins its circular path is clear and familiar to the ATV folks. Carla Leahy and her team, unfamiliar with the trail or the terrain, only know they are at another juncture in the trail, where the main trail seems to connect up with a second path. Both teams radio in their GPS coordinates, and after Ken Anderson plots them on one of his maps, they see Carla's position is about a half mile south of the pickup team. Within 15 minutes, the two groups have connected. 1C is happy they have been able to solve the problem, but the mishap plants a thought. Before dawn, more ground pounders have shown up. They are sent off in a multitude of directions. Some up the trail. Some head to the juncture and turn west in a clockwise fashion, searching for signs along the southern border of the loop. Carla Leahy and the other dog handlers feed their hard-working animals, then have something to eat themselves, and lie down in their vehicles to warm themselves and get some badly needed rest. crowded into or near 1C are Pete Smurid, Ken Anderson, BJ, Pete Walsh, Rebecca Francis, Jeff Hossie, and Sherry Wright. They have worked through possible scenarios for where Jason might have gone. Now that the maps are up on the wall, one of the most likely appears to be along the eastern and northern trails, identified on the map as the Northern Loop and Eastern Loop. In both instances, sucker trails lead away from the correct powwow trail. They surmise it was at one of these sucker trail junctures that, hours earlier, Carla Leahy's team went astray. And she was sure she was at the right location, the juncture where the trail starts its circular march. The mistake hasn't gone unnoticed, and the new theory, the one being mulled over when the radio crackles with a call from the plane, is that Jason was suckered off the main trail by a phantom path. 20. Stevens finds his way. Knife Lake, International Border, Friday, August 8, 1998. In the first gray light of dawn, Dan Stevens peels back the birch bark covering and rises in pain to the day. It has been another troubling night. There was the dream, whose details he now recalls as though the map lay on a table in front of him, illumined with a halogen lamp. His legs are painful, his feet burn, and the goddamn carpenter ants have made another meal of him. His scratched eye is taut and bleary. He's starting to shiver from the early morning cold, knowing he should get over the crest of his hill. And he has back pain from lying coiled in birch bark and broadleaf on hard ground. Otherwise, he reflects, remembering his plan and yesterday's solid southern progress, he feels pretty good. He is comforted by his agenda and his ability to adhere to it. He crosses the ridge, hoping to warm himself in the sun that breaks over the sea of trees. He moves around, trying to warm himself, considering his day and the long trek ahead of him. After he is fully awake, he recrosses the ridge line and checks his markers. They are all aligned in the early morning light. He looks out across the lowland in front of him, to where the land bellies up to a distant rise. He looks down at his southern pointing stick, double-checking it with the other sticks he meticulously laid out the previous evening and in the middle of the night when he rose to piss under the North Star. Their corroboration gives him confidence. He looks off in the direction of the southern pointer, sighting a high white pine on the distant ridgeline, knowing he will be able to keep it in sight. Then he strikes off down the hillside and starts pushing through more brush. At first light, the OPP rises on the no-name lakeshore. Even before the sun breaks, the members have breakfasted and are in the woods. One team works its way north of camp. Three others spread southward in a fan. Scott Moore climbs into the copter and starts crossing coordinates plotted on the map, methodically searching for any sign. Throughout the morning, the ERT covers its grid. By mid-morning, Dan Stevens is ravenous. In a patch of shaded sawgrass, he finds a lethargic hopper. Between his fingers, it is sluggish in its struggle, still cold in the grass. He pops it into his mouth. He chews quickly and swallows, washing it down with water. It passes so quickly over his tongue that it has the flavor of water with the continued bitter aftertaste of the previous day's arrowroot. He can feel his body absorb the morsel, and he appreciates the tiny addition to his diet. He knows he is slowly starving, knows he has to find more food. But he has reserves. He will hike today. Tomorrow he will forage and feed. He returns to the shaded grass, walking south. Over the next hour he finds seven more hoppers and pops them into his mouth, washing them down with water. By noon he climbs to the top of his next rise, a very high ridge, and looks south. There, at the base of the slopes, lies a lake that appears to feed into a longer lake. He smiles, believing the longer lake must be Otter Track. If he is right, there should be a portage trail from this lake into Otter Track. That means an open place where he might encounter canoeists. He is exhausted, but pleased. He has made better time than he expected. He spends the next hour hiking down the steep slope through the woods. He comes down to the water's edge, happy to be here, pleased to have hiked under his own power through such difficult terrain, and found his own way out. The bank is open and warm. He drinks heavily of the lake. He sits back, thinking again of food. He has avoided crayfish and snails. At times he has thought about them and all the other possible edible things. Under his shadow, the small crustaceans scurry for cover. He has avoided raw meat, particularly something that lives in fresh water, because he is afraid of bacteria or parasitic giardia. A parasite could slow his process considerably, weaken him with the dangerous fits of diarrhea or vomiting. But now hunger drives him to sit on the bank and await the return of the crayfish. He looks up. His grazed eye is bleary. It weeps, and he frequently closes it, relying on his other eye to see the trail. Now he looks out over the lake's placid blue surface and is startled by a silver flash. He looks down, starting to feel weak. He waits. He continues looking down for a full minute before rising to squint again across the water. The streak has moved. The goddamn silver object has moved. But it is still there, across the water in plain sight. "Hey!" he finally yells. His voice cracks. He has not spoken in almost 24 hours, and his larynx squeaks like a rusted hinge. "Hey!" he clears his throat. He calls again, but there is no answer. Dan Stevens sits down, wondering if he is mistaken, if his longing to see a canoe has prompted his imagination to conjure one. But the day is beautiful. There is a slight breeze across the water. The sky is open, a deep azure. He sits quietly and listens. He believes he sees two people in the canoe. He can barely hear them talk. He doesn't understand what they're saying, but he hears words and the jangling their lures make when they cast. "Hey!" he yells again. "I'm lost. I need help. Do you have any food? Where's your camp?" Amazingly, the canoe remains stationary, quiet, as though they haven't seen or heard him. Except for occasional words and the flinging of their lures, the canoeists remain still. He knows they are near enough to hear him. He calls for several more minutes before one of them finally turns and asks, "How do we know you won't rob us?" in a thick New Jersey accent. Stevens is so happy to hear another voice, he is stunned by the question. He starts laughing. "We're 20 miles from nowhere. What am I going to steal, your hat and fishing pole?" "Maybe," the words come back petulant, young, and nervous. The canoe glides close enough for Stevens to discern the Summers canoe base insignia. They're scouts out of his own camp. "I'm a leader out of the Summers canoe base," he explains. "I've been lost 3 days." He tells them everything. The brief outline of his odyssey tumbles out of his mouth. When they refuse to come closer, he recites the Boy Scout creed. He explains the different levels of scouting and what it takes to advance. "Why don't you swim out to us?" one of the boys finally asks. Until now, Dan has been more than patient. In his summer of guiding, he has met young scouts from all over the country. Most of them he has appreciated. Very few have been spoiled, morose, mean-spirited, or obviously forced to come on an adventure they didn't appreciate. For these young scouts he has felt empathy, then the need to administer discipline. He has mastered the authority voice, the one to use when dealing with kids who buck the system, or his leadership. From the sounds of it, these kids are from Jersey, maybe the inner city. But today he doesn't have time or patience to coax them. His temper is razor-thin, and that kind of empathy is a luxury of the well-fed. In the midday light, Stevens' eyes narrow. "Get in here and pick me up," he says in a voice with unmistakable steel in it, a resolve not to be ignored. "Now," he adds, in a way that leaves no doubt about his meaning. The voice works. There is movement across the water. The two Jersey scouts turn and call to another canoe Stevens hasn't seen. The other canoe rounds a point, and together they both paddle in for a closer look. When they are close enough to see Stevens's condition, long hair gnarled and matted, straggly beard growth, torn and filthy shorts and shirt, legs badly abraded, they can see the truth and paddle in to get him. Dan Stevens is stunned by his good fortune. He quickly forgives the boy's truculence, happy to be talking again, particularly to people. Questions tumble out of him, inane and unabated. "How's the fishing? How long have you been out? Where are you headed? When are you going back?" They answer his questions, incredulous at what they found. Stevens climbs into the second canoe. skinny as a tall pine trunk, with legs that look as though their outer layer has been stripped, the Eagle Scout jabbers on. He is happy to be talking again. He is pleased to be back in a canoe traveling easy. He doesn't notice the way they look at him, as though he's alien. They cannot quite believe his story, but the legs don't lie. They are as raw as a third-degree burn, and they glisten in the midday light with a moist layer of fresh blood. The paddlers dig in and ferry Stevens to their camp, which lies around a far point, nestled below a stand of cathedral pines. To the right of the pines, a brook rushes over boulders into the lake. Once in camp, the others who are sitting around the fire ring or casting for fish from the shore crowd around Stevens. He repeats his story, takes his turn to answer questions. Cameras come out, and the kids and adults start snapping photos. Suddenly, he's a rock star. A ravenous rock star. One of the adults is a Jersey cop. Shortly after Stevens is out of the canoe, the policeman is on the radio with the Summers canoe base. From the base, the call relays up to the OPP. The OPP radios the ERT, and within minutes, Scott Moore, who is piloting the helicopter on yet another swing south, hears that Stevens has been found. The pilot takes down the coordinates, and Scott Moore knows the place. Little Knife Lake, adjoining Otter Track and Knife Lakes, on the Canadian side not too far northeast of Prairie Portage. The helicopter angles west-southwest in the midday sun. Scott Moore is anxious to see if it is their man. Within 15 minutes, Moore is hovering over the campsite. He and the pilot can see the canoes on the shore and bits of camp under the trees. There is no clear place to land. The only open place near the camp is at the stream's mouth, where the water rushes into the lake. 50 yards to the right of camp, a large boulder sits at the edge of the stream. Moore points toward the boulder. The pilot nods and angles the bird in. "I think I can touch down one of her legs on that boulder," he yells, pointing at the rock. Moore nods. "Take her in and I'll go fetch him." They've already talked with the group by relayed radio. They know Stevens is ambulatory. He has wolfed down several granola bars and a sandwich, warding off the early stages of starvation, and has painfully sore feet and legs, but they're pretty certain he can make it into the chopper under his own power. Back in Fayetteville, Jim and Mary Ann Stevens are hanging, awaiting word. It has been a difficult 3 days. Their old house in Monroe and the new one in Fayetteville have operated as central communication centers, keeping their network of family and friends apprised of any new developments, though there have been few. Dan's parents have wondered how people get through an ordeal like this without the fellowship of a church and a powerful faith. The last 3 days have been absorbed by the move, the closing on the Monroe home, the only time they have been away, a blur of phone calls, and more prayer, more entreaties for divine intervention than either of them can ever remember making. At 3:30 p.m., the phone rings.
"We've got him," Doug Hurdler says. "And he's fine. I guess he's a little scraped up, but otherwise okay."
Jim's eyes fill with sudden tears. Marianne's throat closes with the rush of emotion. Both of them are mute while Hurdler gives them more details, though there aren't many. When they are able to speak, they pepper him with questions, especially, "Can we talk to him?" Hurdler explains that he hasn't actually spoken with their son. Dan is still in the woods, but they should hear from him soon. 10 minutes later, Sergeant Heather Lacey is on the phone to Jim and Marianne, confirming Hurdler's phone message.
"We found him, and he's okay," she blurts.
She explains that none of the searchers has yet seen Dan, but who else would walk out of the woods on the edge of wilderness, scratched up and starving, and claim to be Dan? Lacey has never met Jim or Marianne, but over the last 48 hours she has grown familiar with the parents' worry. She is happy to finally have something that offers them solace. Over the wires from Georgia, the tired, ecstatic silence is followed by more weeping and questions. At the Summers canoe base, the Chattanooga scouts have been bored and shunned, at least by some of the other scouting troops. The word of their predicament spread the day the scouts returned. Some of the Summers groups have been critical of their decision to leave their guide. The boys sense occasional blame by those who have no idea how the incident unfolded. Tired of the glances and unspoken accusations, they have come into Ely to kill time and visit outfitters. Ely has a 4 or 5 block Main Street where outfitters, stores, and restaurants compete for the tourist trade. Kathy Antle, in to pick up supplies on her day off, runs into the scouts on Main Street. She tells them there is no word of Dan, that the OPP is still searching. Then she watches them turn into one of the town's biggest outfitters, where the Chattanooga group loses itself perusing top-of-the-line equipment. Some of the best canoes and gear in the world hang from ceilings and shelves, and these scouts ogle the assemblage. Back at her truck, Kathy Antle has to check in with the station. Carrie Frechette gives her the excited word on Dan's appearance. Kathy rushes back to the store. The troop of 8 are still mulling over equipment. She sees Tim Jones and blurts,
"They found Dan. He's fine."
The others gather around the ranger, doubting they heard right.
"He walked out on his own and was picked up by the OPP less than an hour ago. Dan Stevens is safe."
People walking along Main Street hear the scream go up. A block away, heads turn toward the collective yell. Kathy hugs Tim Jones and he holds on. Tears well in Jerry Wills's eyes. Dan Stevens is alive. He is safe. For the first time in 3 long days, Tim Jones, Jerry Wills, and the teenagers feel a full measure of relief. With minimal assistance, Dan manages the brief hike to the helicopter. Scott Moore helps him through the door. Flying over the wilderness through which he struggled for the last 3 days, using the sun, stars, and his own dead reckoning, he is stunned at the speed with which they close the distance from the border to Atikokan. At the hospital, he has his first opportunity to see a doctor and get cleaned up. Not long after his examination and shower, he gets a dose of penicillin. Dan is exhausted, but restless. He needs to call Fayetteville. At around 5:30 p.m., the Stevens' phone rings. Jim picks it up and hears, "Dad? It's Dan." Again, Jim is speechless, struck mute by the familiar sound of his son's voice. Dan spends the next several minutes describing his ordeal. There is too much to tell, but he can sense his parents' relief. He tells them he is sure he'll be home soon. Given the condition of his legs, he doesn't expect to be finishing out his term as a guide. After the call, he feels elated, like an athlete who has just given an amazing performance. He is jocular in the hospital room, but still polite and respectful, in the manner in which he was raised. When Constable Jim McGill comes through his door, Dan Stevens is ready to tell his story. 21. The Tent. Northeast of the Powwow Trail, BWCAW. Tuesday, October 30, 2001. By 8:40 a.m., Nick Milkovich and pilot Dean Lee are focusing their air search on a large triangle of woods marked by Isabella Lake in the north-northeast, Fern Lake in the east, and Pose Lake in the northwest. Although the previous evening turned cold, freezing some of the water along the shorelines, the weather is again moderating. Sometime in the early morning the thermometer rises above freezing. In the last 5 days of freeze and thaw, the heavy snow blanket covering the area has gradually thinned. The warmth finally has its way with the thick white cover over Jason's tent. With little fanfare and the sound of a broom brushing nylon, the snow slides to either side of the orange fly. Now the tent sits atop the moss-covered hump like a preternatural beacon. At 9:20, barely into their customary routine, Milkovich and Lee spot something on a clear rise west of Arrow Lake. They have flown over the spot more than 20 times and seen nothing but a big hill covered in white with a long beaver pond south of it and a swampy bog to the north. Now they see what appears to be an orange tent. They are dumbfounded.
"I think we found a tent," Nick stammers across the radio to 1C. "But I know it wasn't there yesterday."
Back at 1C, they ask for a repeat, wanting to be sure they've heard him correctly.
"A tent," Milkovich repeats. "We are pretty sure we found a tent. The only thing is, I know it wasn't there yesterday."
At 1C, BJ and Pete Smirud talk it over with Rebecca Francis, Ken Anderson, and Sherry Wright. Did they send any searchers into that area to spend the night? Would any of them set up camp on their own? Could any winter campers have slipped down the trail without their knowing? Not a chance, they reason. For the last 5 days there has been perpetual occupation of the parking lot. There is no way seasonal backpackers could have gotten around them unnoticed, and there is virtually no other way into that region. It doesn't make sense.
It's an orange tent?
BJ radios for clarification.
An orange tent, Milkovich repeats.
He's excited by the find. The plane is turning circles over the spot. Others on the radio frequency, out in the field, have picked up on the discovery. The airwave chatter is starting to increase. Questions start flying.
Only thing is, Milkovich manages to get out through the din, there is no way to get there from the trail.
He sounds incredulous. It doesn't make sense. BJ radios back for more clarification.
There is an orange tent, she repeats. It is on a rise west of Arrow Lake, but there is no way in or out?
Affirmative, Nick rockets back. Not that I can see. Bogs and swamp between it and the trail, which appears to be a good 2 miles to the west.
The plane circles over the spot to determine the GPS coordinates and looks for more signs. Before Milkovich and Lee started their triangular air search, conservation officers Kip Duncan and Marty Stage decided to take the ATVs up the trail, just to have another look around. 1C gave them the okay, and by 8:30 a.m. they were throttling north, sliding and splashing through the muddy terrain. They've come up to the circular juncture and turned counterclockwise. At the point where the new powwow trail makes a 90-degree turn to the left, they keep heading straight onto the old powwow trail. They hear the plane making tight circles in the sky, and they know something's up. By the time their radios pick up Milkovich's chatter, they are much closer to the plane than to 1C. They hear Milkovich clarify the tent's position. Then they check it on their own GPS devices, which is when they realize they are within a mile of the location. From this particular point, radio transmission back to 1C is static-ridden and garbled. They can hear Milkovich, but he cannot hear them. "We are heading in to take a look," Marty Stage finally says, hoping 1C will pick it up. He explains their location and estimates that they should be able to reach the tent within the hour.
"I'm not sure you can get there from where you're at," they manage to pick up from 1C. "I'm not sure they've heard Milkovich correctly."
"We've got good enough coordinates," Stage repeats. "We'll get there."
Stage and Duncan have traversed their share of rough country. It is wet and cold, but not impassable. The day is moderating nicely. The sky is overcast, but it is bright, and the clouds are high enough so they can follow the plane's tight circular flying pattern through the brush and trees. They park their ATVs beside the old powwow trail and start bushwhacking. Far to the southwest, Deputy DeRozier, Ron Van Bergen, Dan Spina, and Terry Olson are somewhere along the southwestern end of the trail, heading toward the Superstition Spur. As soon as they lock in on the tent's coordinates, they turn around and start back toward the area where the two Coes dropped off their ATVs. 1C dispatches two dog crews with support to the area. Carla and Dale Leahy are also approaching the drop-off point with their dogs. Jeff Hossie and a couple of others are with the group. Even with ATVs, it is a slow migration. Now everyone in the field struggles to converge on the tent. As soon as the tent is spotted, Steve Van Kekerix is notified. For the first time in days, he has something positive to tell the Rasmussens, who are back in the cities, updating family, neighbors, and friends. The news raises a dizzying swirl of emotions. On the one hand, they are elated to know the searchers have found his tent. On the other, it sounds like there is no movement, no tracks. They are damned anxious, and would hardly have believed it was possible that the anxiety and dread they had endured for the past 5 days could deepen even further. And the undersheriff can tell them little. Rescuers are converging on the point. Apparently it is remote. He will contact them as soon as he knows anything more. The Rasmussens ring off. In the house on Quinn Road, they feel reasonably certain they will know Jason's fate within a matter of 2 to 3 hours. They feel their last hope of seeing their son alive start to waver. Deputy Milkovich explains that in order to reach the site, all crews will have to go over some nasty swamp, bog, maybe even a river. But they will keep circling, giving them a good idea of the location. In the chaos of radio blather, Milkovich and Lee don't even know that Kip Duncan and Marty Stage are slogging across the heavy terrain. For the next hour, the two Kos struggle through bog and swamp. In places, they are almost hip-deep in muck. It is hard going. Their feet and calves grow numb in the icy waters.